to All Together Now. This is Charlene Spretnak. I hope you caught the broadcast of Bill Moyers and Company last Friday evening when his guest was Dr. Sandra Steingraber, who was on this program last September and is a leading activist biologist in the issues of environmental toxins, including those used and released in fracking. In fact, I think she's in jail right now. She had to go to jail for 2 weeks in Ithaca, New York, in the county jail for a protest demonstration of the fracking trucks coming into their community because of what can clearly be seen has happened in Pennsylvania and communities where fracking has been going on. Anyway, on this program last Friday on Bill Moyers, she was very informative and inspiring as usual. So if you want to listen to the program or read the transcript, it's on the Bill Moyers and Company website under the April 19th program. The title was The Toxic Attack on Our Children. And truly, with all the drastic increases in the number of children being born with neurological birth defects, why is this industrial chemical poisoning allowed to go on and on, no matter which party is in office year after year? Of course, it's rationalized as all part of the endless economic expansion, without which, we are told, our society would collapse in an instant. But is that true? Is that the only way? And is it at all rational to be running endless growth economies on a planet with a finite amount of what are called natural resources? Now, the first American economist that I know of who ever thought this through was Herman Daly, known today as the father of ecological economics in this country. He's a professor emeritus of ecological economics in the School of Public Policy at the University of Maryland, and he was formerly at the World Bank, where he worked on issues of sustainability and development. Herman Daly pioneered the concept of steady-state economics back in the early 1970s, a concept that has everything to do with slowing down the tear that we're on in industrialized countries, treating the earth, as Herman puts it, as if it were a business in liquidation. Now, back when I was writing the book that's entitled The Resurgence of the Real, that was published in 1997, I included a story at the end. It's one of those William Morris-type utopian plots in which the characters explain to a stranger, a time traveler who goes forward in time, how things got the way they are in that particular place. So in this utopian story, a woman, and this story is set in 2025, a woman tells the time traveler, the stranger, what happened. And I wrote this manuscript in 1995 and 6, and I inserted in this story the fact that she looks back and she says, oh, well, in 1998, the Nobel Prize Committee finally broke their habit of honoring only neoliberal, destructomatic economists year after year. They broke through that thinking and awarded the Nobel Prize in Economics that year, at least in my story, to one of the great pioneers of ecological economics, Herman Daly. So the Nobel Prize doesn't change anything on the ground level, but it does signal from the top the kind of thinking that's respected as, you know, the top level of what the so-called developed countries are doing and how they see these issues. So in the story, the fact that he was named, that signaled a change, a shift, and it helped the so-called undeveloped nations around the world and all the grassroots groups push harder for sane economic policies, which is to say eco-social economic policies. Well, that hasn't quite happened yet, although they did pick Dr. Sen not long after my prediction. But in many other ways, progress is being made to nudge us in the direction of survival. Fast enough? We don't know yet. But today we're going to hear from someone in the next generation of ecological economists and activists, someone who's working to further and flesh out the practical steps society can and needs to take to move beyond our extreme grow-or-die economic system, or I suppose now it can be renamed the grow-and-die economics, if we look at the depletion and toxic pollution it causes. But, you know, the mainstream economists for decades have no problem ignoring those pesky externalities. Well, my guest today is Rob Dietz. He's a writer, researcher, and activist trying to help build a better economy, one that works for people and the planet. He's the editor of The Daily News, spelled D-A-L-Y, in honor of Herman Daly. You can find that online, The Daily News, a popular online publication, yeah, named in honor of Dr. Daly. Rob was also the first executive director of the Center for the Advancement of the Steady State Economy, C-A-S-S-E, CASE. Taking it from an unfunded startup organization to an internationally respected leader on new economic thinking. He regularly writes articles and delivers public presentations that draw from his education and experience in both economics and environmental science. He lives in Corvallis, Oregon, with his wife and daughter, and he has a new book out, co-authored with Dan O'Neill in England. Their title is Enough is Enough, and the subtitle is Building a Sustainable Economy in a World of Finite Resources. So, Rob Dietz, welcome to the program.
Well, thanks a lot, Charlene. It's great to be here. Really appreciate the work that you're doing.
Well, I enjoyed your book a lot because it does lay out such practical steps. And I want to start with just the basic thesis. I mean, this radio program continues the research I presented in Relational Reality, my book in 2011, about all these discoveries and human physiology, about dynamic interrelatedness, just so different from what the biomechanical model of the body had thought, the way we work. We don't work that way. And you can see this in every field. Interrelatedness is really coming to the fore. So when I read this, and you start in the beginning and say, we need to shine a light on, examine this relationship between more is better and the relationship between enough, more and enough. Mm-hmm. So could you start there and tell us about that?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. You know, if it's almost common sense to me. If you think about the idea of enough, you can take examples from your daily life. You know, when you don't have enough food to eat, then more is certainly better. You know, we don't want to see anybody suffering from famine or starvation. So, you know, in that case, more is better. But once you do have enough, consuming past that point is unhealthy. And you can look at that, it's not just food. You could look at it from the point of view of sleep. You could look at it from the point of view of consumption of material goods. Mm-hmm. There is a point we can reach where, you know, this point of enough that is the healthiest for us. It's the optimal point. So, and that's something that our economy and our mainstream economists seem to have some blockage about. There is no enough when it comes to production and consumption in the aggregate in the economy. Right. So that's the change that we're proposing.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think a wake-up call maybe has been the recent studies on income inequality. I know I'm jumping a bit here the way your book is set up, but I think that got people to really look at the fact that when some people have way more than enough, and a lot of people don't have enough for basic needs, the whole society gets skewed. You get a lot more mental illness, you get more violence, you get, less of an educational level. it really demonstrated with the statistics what happens when things get really skewed in the way our society has in the last 20 or 30 years.
Yeah, there's no doubt. I mean, the studies that you're pointing out, they're conclusive. The evidence is quite clear that if we can reduce the gaps between rich and poor, you know, have a more equitable society, we'll all be better off, even those sitting at the, you know, the very highest income echelons. So, you know, that's certainly a winning strategy for all groups, all people in society. You know, it's gotten amazing the size of the gaps. I just saw, I mean, you can find things like this in the news all the time. I just saw the other day that the top hedge fund manager in 2012 earned $1,057,692 per hour. So, you know, that's as much as the average American family makes in 21 years' time. So, you know, this one hour of work, you know, in finance on Wall Street is equal to 21 years of work for the rest of us. So, you know, I think most people see that as absurd. And, you know, and it has deeper problems for our democracy. You know, is it a true democracy when certain individuals control so much wealth, which means they control so much power and access to the media and influence with our policymakers? And, you know, so certainly if we're talking about an economy that is limited in size, it's not going to be expanding forever, we need to think about how we're distributing the wealth and income in that economy, and having it be as skewed as it is now is a really unhealthy situation. And there are certainly ways that we can work on policies that will help us fix that situation and then again be healthier for all of us.
Well, do you see a broad recognition of this, though? I mean, the book The Spirit Level, that two social scientists did in England, really made the case comparing countries that have this wide disparity in incomes versus countries that have a much smaller gap in their disparity of incomes. And then Peter Corning did a book, a similar idea. So it's not that it hasn't gotten some ink in the media, but I don't hear it talked about in the mainstream media. And even cases like your hedge fund manager, it's dispiriting to find in the polls that some people don't think that's unfair or a problem because they think they're going to get rich like that.
Yeah. Well, you know, I've certainly been shouted at for this idea that we've got to have a fair distribution of wealth. You know, some people, they get offended. They take the viewpoint that anything you can earn, you should be able to to take home. And
right. No limits.
Yeah, but I think there's a couple pieces to it. One, it's tied up in this culture of infinite expansion. You know, there's these old sayings that economists throw around, like the rising tide lifts all boats, or you know, we don't need to decide how to cut up the cake if we have a cake that expands forever. I mean, these are seductive ideas, but they're simply not available to us in the real world. So we know that technology can push back the limits to growth, and that we have been able to expand the size of the so-called cake. But the reality is that we live on a finite planet, and we've got to figure out how to share the resources with each other and with the other species that inhabit this place too. So it really does get to the point of, okay, how can we distribute the wealth and income fairly? And part of it is not having these massive gaps. You know, it's and I think that plays into a cultural phenomenon too, which you know, I think you were getting at, is we have a little bit of a lottery sensibility going on right now, where you know everybody thinks they're going to be at the top of this pyramid when there just aren't very many slots there, and most of it has to do with the family you were born into. I mean, you know, if you look at the heirs to the Walmart fortune, you know, the six people that inherited money from the founders of Walmart have as much wealth as the 150 million poorest Americans. So again, it's just these kinds of stats bring it home. But I don't think it's you know, it's as widespread as it ought to be. This is something that you know, just from a standpoint of fairness, from a standpoint of fixing our democracy, that we should be addressing, you know, in Congress, in our states, you know, with state laws, with within our own businesses, how we set up ownership. There's a lot of ways that we can decrease that gap and improve everybody's health.
Right. I think, in addition to what you call the lottery mentality, which I think is very true, you know, there's also a lack of political historical awareness of how the way the so-called cake is split has been shifted since the 1970s to favor the wealthy and put more burden on the middle class and the working class. So it is, as you say, a skewing of our democratic process. It's very clear that money has talked and changed tax laws, changed all kinds of laws, putting more of a burden on students, on people for medical costs, shifting everything onto the working individual while the people at the top take in even more and more and more with the tax cuts. So I want to move into what I think is really great about your book, and it talks about a number of different areas and shows this common theme, how running this kind of thinking through all the areas that are in crisis now could really move us in the right direction. And it feels very whole. It doesn't feel like, oh, well, I'll run over here and patch this problem, and then maybe we can run over here and fix this one. So I think that what you do in this book, Enough is Enough, is it's encouraging that way. I finished the book and I thought, you know, if we could just say, okay, folks, I know we don't like any radical moves in the United States. Let's just do 10% in this direction, you know, over the next 3 years, and then see if we want to do another 10% and then another 10%, because it makes such sense. And people at the top are not getting it, that, you know, you can be in your walled-in enclave, but you're surrounded by a rotten culture that's just not working for most people. So what's that going to be like? So anyway, let's move into sort of this, what sort of economy does provide what you call enough?
Yeah, well, you know, you started off the show talking about Herman Daly and his pioneering work with the steady state economy.
Yeah.
And that is the kind of economy that is aiming for enough rather than always chasing after more. And at its very simplest, a steady state economy means that we've got a relatively stable number of people consuming a relatively stable amount of resources, and that's all within the ecological capacity of the planet. Now, so I think most people can get that conceptually, but then really what one of the things that drove Dan and I to write the book was that we wanted to know, okay, well, what would this really mean? You know, when you take the world as it is today with this growth-obsessed economy, well, you know, when the growth, I was going to say ends, but you could even say when the growth slows down, there's a sense of panic that comes about. You know, oh my gosh, we're going to lose jobs. Oh, we're going to have problems with the financial system. We're going to have all kinds of serious debt issues, and you know, and what are businesses going to do? And so we wanted to address those issues. We wanted to know, how can we have a non-growing economy, you know, one that has a sustainable scale? How are we going to do that and address things like employment and things like limiting the amount of resources, energy, and materials that are flowing through the economy. So that's really what the book does. And I have to also say that you know, the main reason that I wanted to get involved is I was just tired, you know, feeling the malaise that comes with constant reading about what's happening to the climate, about the billions of people living in poverty around the world, about you know, what's happening to various natural resources like depletion of topsoils and aquifers. And if you trace all that back to why it's happening, it's because the economy is simply growing too big for the environmental systems in which it sits.
Right.
And so we wanted that to find that hopeful way out. And I hope that's what, you know, these chapters that you're talking about that describe what we could do instead, I hope that it does that for readers. That was really our ultimate goal with this work.
Well, you start out by saying, let's rethink throughput, what the economists call throughput. So that's, you know, taking what they call the natural resources, as if nature exists only as the raw material
right.
for our businesses, and putting them through our factories and then out onto the waste dumps as fast as possible. But this, I think, was Herman's key idea, as I remember back in the early 70s, how to limit that resource use in a way that would still fit in with a market economy.
Yeah. Well, you know, Herman has posed what I think is a really good question to the economists who refute the idea that there are limits to the growth of the economy. You know, a lot of economists, they'll say, well, we don't have to worry about limiting the flow of material and energy because efficiency improvements will take care of that. We'll get so efficient that you don't have to worry. And so he turns that around and says, well, if that's the case, why don't you just put a cap on resources? And then if efficiency really does improve that much, then there's no... You don't need to use more resources. You just get more and more and more efficient with what you've got. And of course, you know, no one's going to agree to that because it's against their ideology. But also, you know, what Herman realized, you know, because he studied physics, is that there are limits to efficiency. So, you know, the notion that that efficiency will save us, it tends to go against the laws of thermodynamics. So, if we can agree.
Isn't it odd how efficiency has caused the suffering of people, the very much increased suffering of people, because what they do is say, oh, you know, we've got this new computer or something. You can work a lot harder. We're laying off everyone around you, and you can do triple the work you used to. You know, unpaid overtime. And I mean, they put the squeeze on people even when these efficient machines come in.
Yeah, it's one of the things that is often left out of the calculations. We don't look at the costs, actually, of sometimes becoming more efficient or of a higher technology.
Well, how business is going to handle that, you know,
Yeah, it does cause disruptions to society. But you know, with throughput, if you look at the facts, if you check out the evidence, it's clear that we are using resources faster than they can be regenerated. The Global Footprint Network does excellent work on this by calculating the ecological footprint, which is a measure of the land resources that are needed to produce the goods and services that we produce in the economy and to absorb the wastes that are emitted from it. So, and what they've found is that we are in a tight spot. We're in an overshoot situation where today, right now, the global economy is using resources 50% faster than they can be regenerated.
50%? So wow.
Yeah. And, you know, if we continue business as usual, we're going to need two Earths worth of resources by 2050. So, you know, and you can do that for a little while, but it means that you're liquidating your stock of natural capital, and it doesn't bode well for future generations or for conserving the diversity of habitats on this planet. So the idea with the throughput limits is to figure out what is the way to put a cap on energy and materials flowing through the economy with the least amount of impingement on personal choice.
Mm-hmm.
So you can take a fairly heavy-handed approach with something like a ban, and that can work for some kinds of resources. You know, we actually had very good success banning lead. It was an additive to gasoline and to paint, and once we, once scientists realized that it was so toxic and causing all kinds of horrible effects, we just simply said no more.
Mm-hmm.
But as I said, that's kind of heavy-handed. So there are ways, we've got cap and trade schemes that can work. My favorite policy for limiting throughput is actually conservation of land areas. You know, things like national parks, national wildlife refuges are areas that we set aside specifically to keep them out of economic production. And so I think striking a balance between having a healthy conservation estate and the other kinds of lands, agricultural, urban.
That strikes me as the most insecure. I can just see people in the future just boiling over and saying, "We have to have that land now. We're in a desperate straits for the resources. It's not like it was when they made." I mean, having fought for county parks, state parks that all get undone, you think you're safe when you get the federal designation, but then they let mining go in right around the perimeter of the federal parks. And anyway, you could be right. I just it feels to me like people could overrun that land, and just say it's time, we have to go in there and get it.
Well, you know what? I definitely agree with you. I think it is insecure if we continue down the infinite growth path. And that's why in the book I think you mentioned it earlier, we basically put together a whole blueprint. And I think, if you start down the path of one of the solutions, they can be cascading. You know, oftentimes people think of crises as cascading, but also solutions can follow one another. And so, if you set aside, and we're doing, by the way, a horrible job with our conservation lands. Read into the conservation biology literature, we're really good at conserving rocks and ice and not so much a bunch of the other ecological systems that are out there. So if we can get a healthy set of conservation areas combined with the other policies, changing business, changing the way the financial and monetary
We'll move into those other areas. I just have to pause now for the break, and then we'll come back and move into this broader map you've laid out, which is so interesting. So we'll pause now for the break, and this is Charlene Spretnak on All Together Now, speaking with my guest, Rob Dietz, co-author of Enough is Enough. Welcome back to All Together Now. This is Charlene Spretnak speaking with my guest, Rob Dietz, co-author of Enough is Enough. Now, I just want to quickly go through these different areas because we're not going to get time for all of them, so I want people to know how comprehensive this vision really is, strategies of enough. Enough throughput, we've talked about a little bit, enough people, enough inequality, enough debt, enough miscalculation, how we measure progress, enough unemployment, enough business as usual, enough materialism, changing our consumer behavior, enough silence, engaging politicians and the media, enough unilateralism, changing national goals and improving international cooperation, enough waiting, taking action to start the transition. So before we leave throughput, and I'd like to get into those measures of progress because the whole GDP fixation is still foremost in the media and politicians' minds. But I think the most striking thing when Herman Daly was thinking through steady state economics in the 1970s, he said, well, you know, for each resource, we could decide on a certain level we're going to use every year. And the government could auction off or distribute, in some cases, you know, for various reasons, permits. And then the people with the permits could sell them, trade them, do whatever they want in a market economy. And we wouldn't be always ramping up the level of the resource that we're using. So it seemed at that time like there was nothing like that to think about. But now that they have all these cap and trade schemes where they give these permits for making carbon dioxide emissions and people will trade them, it's not the same thing, but it's kind of in the ballpark. California's moving ahead with that. Jerry Brown said he's linking up the cap and trade system in California with, I think it was Quebec, it was a province in Canada who has a similar one, and they'll deal back and forth. So do you feel there's some forward motion on that idea of giving out permits for a certain level of a resource every year?
Yeah, I think there is some forward motion, although there was a setback with the European carbon market collapsing. But I think part of the problem is that, you know, these markets, they need to, the reason that we're setting them up is to limit the CO2 that we're emitting into the air, not to speculate and make a slew of cash. You know, we can't think of it like, the same old story with the stock market, where the idea is just to make money by buying stocks and watching them go up in value. That's not what this sort of a market would be about. But the idea, I think, is sound. And the idea, the first part of it is setting a scientifically based cap. You know, we know that the preeminent climate scientists are telling us we really need to get back to 350 parts per million CO2 in the atmosphere, and we're almost to 400 now, and most of the predictions about what that means seems like each year the reality is worse than the most dire prediction that we had from the previous year. So So that's number one, is let the science inform the level of throughput. And then the second piece is, well, who actually gets the permits for the activity? And one of the ideas is that you would share this with all citizens. You know, who owns the atmosphere? Well, we could basically say no one and everyone. Mm-hmm. So the idea that a company or an industry can just emit whatever it wants, that's no longer the case. You would distribute permits to all citizens, and then if somebody wants to emit a certain amount of carbon dioxide, they've got to have the permits to do that. So that might mean purchasing them from citizens who are using less than their share of CO2 emissions. So I think it's a sound idea, and one that has the fairness built into it, and one that has less impingement than just saying, oh, you just can't emit.
So you don't favor the carbon tax?
Oh, I think we ought to be going down that front as well. I mean, basically at this point in history, I think we are in a crisis situation. And so anything that we can do politically to curb our fossil fuel addiction, to curb the amount of CO2 and other greenhouse gases that are entering the atmosphere, we've got to explore those.
Yeah, definitely, I agree. Okay, let's take a look at a big change which is slowly coming into the center from the margins, and that's changing the way we measure progress. You call that, enough of the miscalculation. What's that about?
Yeah, well, GDP has been attacked for decades by
right.
people who are willing to look at it. And the idea is, right now GDP is our measuring stick for economic progress.
Gross domestic product.
Yeah, and it's a horrible measuring stick. I mean, gross domestic product or what used to be gross national product. These are measures of money changing hands. It's a measure of the, you know, technically of the dollar value of the final goods and services produced by a nation over the course of a year. Now the problem is it includes all kinds of costs that we'd like to avoid. You know, if I go out and build more prisons, that's good for GDP. If we sell more weaponry, that's good for GDP. If we treat more cancer patients, that's good for GDP. But it's certainly not progress. So the idea is we've got to make a switch. If we want to measure progress, let's do that. Instead of gross national product, let's measure gross national happiness.
Mm-hmm. You know, I read that satirical article you wrote about this on the Daily News. Could you tell my listeners about that?
Yeah, I every once in a while I get a little frustrated with what's happening, so I take the humor route. And it's funny, when you were mentioning earlier how you wrote that future-looking piece about Daly winning the Nobel Prize, I actually wrote one that was about a character I made up named Milton Mountebank winning the Nobel Prize for infinite planet theory. And of course, a few people thought it was serious. You know, so, but the most recent one that you're mentioning is I did kind of a little bit of a mock interview with an economist accountant at the Bureau of Economic Analysis, saying that they were finally ready to add some better measures of progress. You know, things like the gross domestic imperviousness. You know, looking at how fast we're paving the planet, and a few other measures like that. So it was.
They were very proud that it took them how many decades to change from GNP to GDP.
Right. And, you know, it's kind of sad because, it was a satire, but it's not that far off from the truth, right?
Yeah.
I mean, if we did, if you go and pave over your prime farmland and turn it into shopping malls that bring profits to the developers, then you have increased GDP. There's no question about that. So it's kind of it's a terrible measure of progress and something that needs fixing.
As you say, there are a number of alternatives. I mentioned several of them in Relational Reality. People can take a look there, as well as your book, Enough is Enough. I would like to move into this interesting chapter when you wrote about enough unemployment, securing meaningful jobs, and you talked about the fact that in the Netherlands, a high-income country, of course, people work an average of something under 1,800 hours a year. I'm sorry, 1,400 hours a year, as opposed to in the United States, 1,800 hours a year.
Right. Yeah.
Do they pull that off? And part two of my question is, you mentioned some interesting program there where people kind of can average out their salaries in case they're going to, you know, need to have slightly fallow years in the course of their lifetime. Or anyway, those two things in the Netherlands, what's going on over there?
Yeah, well, they've decided as a nation that they want a better balance in their lives, you know, sort of a work and home life balance. Hmm. And so they've institutionalized some of these things. You know, one of them is, as you're talking about, almost like a time banking thing where you are allowed to bank your hours of work and take longer periods of time off. So at times that are really important for families, like during the at the birth of a child, maternity leave and paternity leave are in a sense more sacred. And being able to leave the workforce and still have a job a couple of years later when you come back in, they've worked out some policies to help with that. And the idea is that really to make it more flexible for people so that we live better lives. I mean, I think all of us, we appreciate hard work. I know I like to at times really push it, but I also like to have the time off and for important things in life. You know, nobody It's a rare person at the end of their life that'll say, gosh, you know, I wish I had spent some more hours in the office and that I had made a few more dollars. You know, it's a lot more you hear the lament that, oh, you know, I wish I'd had a better relationship with my children, or I wish I had learned to play that instrument that I always wanted to play. You know, so I think having these policies that give you a better opportunity for work-life balance, not only can they, you know, can they lead to a more satisfying life, you know, a higher degree of well-being, but they also provide more opportunities for employment because we share the work. And that's why, you know, the Netherlands has been able to do that, because they you know, more people are involved in the workforce. Sure, they've traded some income for more time, but I think you'd find a lot of people in the United States that are willing to do that too.
Yeah. And then another thing you talk about is the new kinds of companies and corporations that are much more community-oriented and have an eco-social dimension to their reason for being. And I was surprised at the numbers. It's quite a lot in the UK and elsewhere.
Yeah.
But, you know, with that, with this whole program, and as I say, I like the way that it just hits all the big areas that are just so problematic for us right now. When you get into this chapter, Enough Silence, Engaging Politicians and the Media, we really need to be doing a better job of that. And I wonder what you thought of what I said earlier. I mean, are you in favor of trying to phase this in all areas, like saying, here's the comprehensive program, let's do this much for the next 3 years, or some other way? I mean, how do you see trying to put this into the political forum in an effective way?
Yeah, well, I'm afraid that I'm probably not as optimistic as you might be that phasing it in will work.
So the
best that I've been able to come up with is that I you know, these are radical changes that we're proposing. I mean, they're not nearly so radical as the idea of destabilizing the climate or trying to achieve infinite growth on a finite planet. But they're radical compared to what we're used to economically. So
yeah, they're at the roots. They go to the root of our assumptions. Yeah.
That's right. And it challenges a lot of worldview. So I don't think we're going to have much success getting this entire economic blueprint adopted, except in the wake of one or more really serious crises. And so my thinking on it is, and it's funny because this comes from Milton Friedman, who, you know, if people study economics, they know that he's an economist who would not, he's deceased now, but he would not have been at all in favor of the kind of economy we're talking about.
Right.
And enough is enough. But he had a really, I think, brilliant insight where he said something along the lines of, you know, it's only in a crisis that real change occurs, and the change that happens depends on the ideas that are lying around. So
I was just thinking of that when I finished your book last night. I was thinking of that very quote. But they were poised when, you know, Reagan was running, all the little think tanks popping up and all the money going into it. And I don't see our side, so to speak, this eco-social analysis and vision being poised in that way. It seems to me it almost never is. Like after the fall of the Soviet Union, those Eastern Bloc countries were like in free fall, and they could have reorganized with a lot of collectives and community serving, you know, market institutions. But instead, what the corporations rushed in with this newsletter, oh, great, you have democracy. That equals laissez-faire capitalism. Here's how you do it. And it just seems that they're always poised more to jump into that moment. Milton Friedman said, yeah, a crisis provides an opening of the moment. But after the crash in the fall of 2008, you know, again, what happened? Nobody leaps in with a strong enough voice to say, this happened, therefore this is going to, you know, be done. What, I mean,
well,
what
I
do you think of
you...
that? We seem to be always, I mean, I know they have, as what I just said, all their think tanks, and they have a lot more money on their side, but it's also got to be a matter of effectiveness now that there are lots more ways to communicate, media options open.
Yeah, well, you know, I think you are hitting a critical point, and you've basically laid out our marching orders. You know, for anybody that wants to see an economy that transitions into something that's sustainable, something that's fair, you know, something that everybody has an opportunity to succeed, well, we've got to get poised. You know, we need to be putting the ideas that are in, you know, in our book, Enough is Enough, or, you know, that Herman Daly has come up with, or the ideas that you've been working on, these ideas have got to be front and center when that crisis comes, because you could see this going all kinds of horrible ways, you know, and in fact, you can see examples in history, whether, you know, Germany coming out of its economic crisis and responding with, you know, the Nazism and the, you know, the horrible things that came down out of that crisis. Well, you know, those were the forceful ideas that were pushed hardest, and so, you know, we've got to, I think we've formulated the ideas now. At least I feel like we have a rudimentary blueprint in our book. So the issue is working to get those front and center, you know. And so I appreciate certainly the work that you're doing to do that. And we've got to pick it up and shout it from as many rooftops as we can.
Exactly. And we're out of time now, but I want to say, since you run the Daily News, that's Daly News, people can find it online, you edit that, I think the next step is a lot of examples of, you know, you have several in the book, which is great, like the Netherlands, but people need to see concrete examples. That's my druthers. I'm watching the clock now, and I do have to go, but I want to thank you so much, Rob Dietz, for coming on the program.
Oh, thank you very much, Charlene. I appreciate it, and you keep up the great work.
Thanks, you too.
All right, take care.
Okay, let's amble over to the Arts Corner and see what we've got there. Our poem for this week is one by Seamus Heaney, who, if you remember, was awarded the Nobel Prize in Literature in 1995. He resides in Dublin, and this poem is about Ireland. It's entitled The Disappearing Island. Once we presumed to found ourselves for good between its blue hills and those sandless shores, where we spent our desperate night in prayer and vigil. Once we had gathered driftwood, made a hearth, and hung our cauldron like a firmament, the island broke beneath us like a wave. The land sustaining us seemed to hold firm only when we embraced it in extremis. All, I believe, that happened there was vision. And for our song this week, well, it was Shakespeare's birthday 2 days ago, April 23rd. So we're going to hear a song that was written by Giuseppe Verdi for his opera Otello, which is based on Shakespeare's play Othello. This is Desdemona's nightly prayer to the Virgin Mary, but it's wrenchingly poignant here because it turns out in Shakespeare's plot to be her last prayer, and she has a strong sense of that. This is Carol Van Ness singing the Ave Maria from Verdi's Otello.
Botello. In case you've missed any of these programs, they're available in the archives. If you like this program, please go to iTunes and like it there. Our theme song is Let's Give Them Something to Talk About, sung by Bonnie Raitt. If you'd like to see who my guests will be for the next few weeks, go to my website, charlenespretnak.com, and click on the tab that says Radio. Next week, my co-host Eleanor LeCain will be here with her guest Mark Armstrong, Executive Director of the Public Banking Institute. I'll be back 2 weeks from today with my guest, Pat Mooney, speaking with us from Toronto about what's up with synthetic biology and geoengineering. Thanks for joining us. This is Charlene Spretnak with All Together Now.